Oops. Okay, there we go. It is on. Can you hear me okay? Good. Wonderful. Okay, so as I mentioned before, as many of you know, our topic for the coming year is going to be the cycle of dependent origination. And so this evening in my talk, I'm going to go over the different steps of this cycle so you kind of have a sense of the lay of the land and what we're going to be getting into over the next 12 months, and then speak a little bit more about the first part of the cycle, ignorance, just to give you a few thoughts and ideas to reflect on in the coming week and get your minds all ready for Tweri's talk on ignorance next Monday, where she'll give a more, deeper view of this subject. Now, I imagine that when some of you heard that we were going to be doing this topic of dependent origination, you might have thought, oh boy, this sounds pretty heavy. I'm not so sure. And I want to reassure you that you're not alone, because I think when several of us local Dharma leaders who are going to be helping teach this topic over the year knew that this was what we were going to be doing, we also felt, oh boy, this might be a pretty big order. You know, maybe we can understand some of it, but to be able to explain it, not so sure. And it can feel like sort of an overwhelming and difficult topic. I think often if we've heard a little bit about it and maybe aren't all that familiar with it, we have sort of an idea that it's very complicated and difficult to understand sort of teaching that has something to do with rebirth and reincarnation and has something to do with cause and effect and has something to do with all these detailed mental processes that are sort of weird and maybe we don't see what it has to do with anything, and we kind of throw up our hands and are like, well, I don't know if I even really want to know about this. But actually, when I think you'll find as we get into working with it and studying it and looking at these different links in the cycle, you will find that it actually makes a lot more sense than you might have had the impression that it does, and is much more accessible and understandable. And also, it's really a very much a core teaching of Buddhism. And so, and really, you know, far from being something that's dry and dull, it really is something very special. And in fact, a teaching that really deals, you know, just as it says in the words of the Dhammapada, with snapping the flowers of desire, flower arrows of desire, and escaping the king of death. So that's something pretty beautiful and dramatic, not at all dull and dry. Now, as I was preparing for this talk, I read an article that was prepared by Christina Feldman, who's one of the guiding teachers and original, you know, core teachers of our insight meditation tradition, who in the past has often come here to do non-residential retreats, although she isn't able to do that at this time because of various reasons. And in this article, she talked about the cycle of dependent origination as being another way of explaining and exploring the second and third noble truths. And I found that a really helpful way of thinking about this. In her words, she says, dependent origination describes the way in which suffering can arise in our lives and the way in which it can end. And so a way of thinking about this cycle of dependent origination, you know, in the Second Noble Truth, it says that the origin of suffering is in craving, and that craving can end. Well, the cycle of dependent origination actually goes into this whole idea that craving is the origin of suffering and gives us a much fuller picture of how that whole process really works and how we can get stuck in this cycle of suffering. Another way of talking about it is to say that it describes how we get caught in this kind of endless cycle of delusion and confusion and always looking for that next pleasant and perfect thing, that cycle of samsara, and how we might escape from that. And this cycle of dependent origination can be approached in a couple of different ways. One way of seeing it is as something that takes place over lifetimes through the actual process of death and rebirth influenced by karma, you know, where this sort of ignorance that's present fuels this whole cycle, and to the extent that the ignorance is still there when we die, kind of that mind stream sort of carries it over to the next cycle and the next cycle until the ignorance is purified. And, you know, for some of this may be a helpful way to think of this cycle, you know, at least in the sense of providing an aspiration to feel like, you know, we would like to be finished with some of our delusion and confusion so we don't have to go back and go through the whole thing over and over again until we finally learn our lesson. But I know that many of us, especially here in the West, we're not quite sure what we think about the idea of rebirth, and it may not be that accessible to us, so maybe not that helpful. But another way of thinking of this cycle also is as something that happens to us every day, in every moment, in our hearts, in our consciousness, that really sort of colors the way we see the world and the experience we create. So in that sense, it's the cycle that happens whenever we notice some pleasant thing, get attracted to it, get attached to it, identify with it, cling to it, build an idea of ourselves around that thing, and then find that maybe it isn't so wonderful after all, or it disappears, or we lose it, and our world comes crashing down. Or, you know, on the other hand, we can build it over something that's very unpleasant that we really want to get rid of and go through that whole process of defining ourselves based on, I'm somebody that doesn't want this thing or doesn't have this thing or am not this thing. So every time we get stuck in that kind of cycle, we're going through this. And I think if you reflect on it, you know that this is something that can happen to us over and over and over again every time we get, you know, caught up in wanting to have more beautiful snow or not wanting to have beautiful snow or, you know, having some idea about ourselves as being like this. You know, all of these things we get caught up in. This cycle happens every time we get caught up and create some new identity and idea of ourselves. And I think how this works, you know, maybe will become a little bit clearer as I go through the cycle and talk about the different steps. So both of these views as something that happens over lifetimes or something that happens over and over again in our present existence, moment to moment. Both of these are equally valid. You don't have to choose one or the other. You can hold both of these views at the same time, just depending on what is actually helpful for you. Although I think sometimes that the viewing it more as something that's happening moment by moment in our current experience is a way of thinking it about it that's maybe more relevant to our day-to-day practice. So one thing also to keep in mind about this cycle of dependent origination is to remember the dependent part, because an important part of this cycle is this idea that all things arise from causes and conditions. So they're all related and dependent on each other, and this includes our suffering and the end of our suffering. In the words of the Buddha, when there is this, that is. With the arising of this, that arises. When this is not, neither is that. With the sensation of that, this ceases. So there's this idea that this cycle doesn't sort of just take place in a vacuum. It happens because certain conditions are present that make it possible for things to arise. And I think this is a very helpful kind of understanding for us to have, this idea of things arising from causes and conditions, when we get to the point of thinking about the things that arise in our own minds. You know, it's very easy to have this sense of, feel this sense of, oh, you know, this is all about me, this is all my fault, which isn't really the case. I mean, we have some responsibility, but there's many different causes and conditions, things that have happened in the past, things about society, things we've done before. All of these different things come together to create the kind of responses and reactions and emotions and feelings that we have. So we have some responsibility for, you know, behaving in a wise way when these things come up. But their arising isn't just all about us, it's about all of these other things. And so I think that's really helpful in the sense of, we don't need to be blaming ourselves so much, blaming everybody else for certain things, but just understanding lots of things happen and come together to create the situation we're in or create what arises in our minds. And then, you know, be wise about what we do with it. So classically, there are 12 links in this cycle of dependent origination. And they're not, you know, like very, you know, strictly sequential and progressive, or one, you know, really causing the next one in a very deterministic way. But it's sort of more like, when all these different conditions come together, then certain other things have the potential to happen. So the first link of this cycle is ignorance. And we don't necessarily have to begin here, but I think it's a very common place to begin and a good place to begin, because this whole cycle really takes place on a foundation of ignorance and is fueled by ignorance. And above all, this ignorance is ignorance of the Four Noble Truths. And this isn't so much, you know, just in the sense that somebody hasn't heard the Four Noble Truths or doesn't know anything about Buddhism, although, you know, maybe that's part of it. But it really goes much deeper than that. So not just we haven't heard of it, but also the ignorance of, you know, really deeply understanding these things, the ignorance of not having experienced them for ourselves. So in the sense that we're caught up in that, you know, very, very common and very human delusion that we all have, that things really ought to be pleasant, that they should stay pleasant, and if we can really get our act together, we ought to be able to make them pleasant and keep them pleasant. And if we're not doing this, then it's got to be our fault, or it's got to be somebody else's fault, to the extent that we're caught up in that idea and we're operating from that idea, we're acting in ignorance of the Four Noble Truths. So it's much deeper than just, have we heard about this? And so anytime we don't see things clearly, when we take what is impermanent to be permanent, when we take what is not really going to provide lasting satisfaction for something that will provide a lasting satisfaction, when we take something that isn't ours and isn't who we are, and think that it is who we are, whenever we're operating from not really knowing what's going on, there is that ignorance. So in that ignorance, we're sort of wandering blindly. Christina Feldman talks about it as wandering blindly or in confusion from one experience to another. So this is sort of this definition of samsara. We're just kind of going along, and we really don't have much of a clue where we're going along to, except in pretty much there's a lot of suffering involved. So there's this foundation of ignorance. And then the next link is formations, or sankharas. And this refers to all of the different kinds of actions and mental ideas. They talk about them as bodily formations or mental formations, states of mind, ideas that arise and are conditioned by this ignorance. So, in other words, it's like refers to all of the thinking and acting processes that are, you know, shaped by ignorance, our habitual reactions, instinctive instincts, preferences, things like that, stuff that we sort of do without even thinking about it, colored by this delusion. So then next there's consciousness. And so consciousness refers to the fact that we have a mind that knows. There we have awareness, that we have the potential to know. And this knowing itself can be sort of colored by the delusions and these habitual reactions. So the knowing in itself can have a certain flavor to it too. The next link is nama rupa, or name and form. So the form or rupa, this refers to all the physical things in our experience, including our own bodies. And then the nama or name refers to the concepts or ideas we have about these physical things. So it's sort of, we have the physical things, and then we have our name for that thing, or our concept of that thing or idea, you know, sort of how we classify or organize all of this physical stuff that we come in contact with. And of course our name or idea about the thing is not exactly the thing itself, but you know, that's something that a whole talk is going to be about, I think. So then we have the six sense doors. So we have seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, thinking. All of these, we have a body and we have the mind that allows us to take in this sort of information. So the equipment that allows us to see, to hear, to smell, to taste, to touch, and the mind that can recognize thought objects. In Buddhism, the mind is also considered one of the sense doors. So this part, these first five that I've been talking about, they, in a way, these are sort of a background, maybe, or these different conditions that are present. We have this foundation of ignorance. We have the potential for thoughts and actions that are conditioned by these ignorance. By this ignorance, we have a body. We have these sense doors, so we're able to take in and perceive all these different kinds of sense information. And we have consciousness that can know these things. So all this stuff is there. And with all of this different stuff coming together and being there, then the next parts of the cycle can happen. So the next step in the cycle is contact. And so contact is what happens when the sense door and sense information and or sense object come together. So we have, like, say, the eye. We have the visual object meeting the eye. We have the consciousness that can recognize it. All of this stuff comes together, and it creates this, you know, experience of seeing this thing that we recognize and name. And, you know, the same with all the other senses. There's this contact of the object, the consciousness, and the sense door coming together to create our experience of this thing, whether it's, you know, a thought that comes or a sound that we hear or something we feel. All of this kind of experiences that sort of create our world and our experience of the world. So all of that stuff, you know, this just sort of happens because we're human beings in this world, seeing and hearing and smelling and knowing things. So the next part of the cycle then is feeling or Vedana. And this is the pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral characteristic that we pick up in relation to all of this different stuff that comes in through our sense doors. So whenever we, you know, see something, touch something, smell something, hear something, think something, it also has this quality, this Vedana along with it of pleasantness, of unpleasantness, or of a neutral, you know, neither pleasant or unpleasant. And, you know, whether we get this sense of pleasant or unpleasant, all this also is sort of conditioned by the ignorance and the habits and so on and so forth. So, you know, something that one person might find pleasant, another person might not find pleasant. And something that one person might find unpleasant, another person, you know, might think is neutral or pleasant. I mean, of course, there's certain things that we pretty much almost all think are pleasant or unpleasant, but it's not so much a characteristic that's really attached to that object, but something we bring with it, bring to it with our conditioning. But I think the main thing is that this kind of sort of comes along in our perception of the object, this pleasantness, unpleasantness, and neutralness. And then the next part of the cycle is craving. And this craving part is what we kind of instinctively tend to do with these pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral objects. And I think the most common way we think of the craving is this sort of impulse to seek out and hang on to any kind of pleasurable sensation or object or experience that comes our way. But I think it's also significant to know that we can also have a craving to get rid of the unpleasant objects, you know. So whenever we, you know, we perceive this pleasant, there's a tendency to move toward it and try to grab onto it and keep it. If it's unpleasant, there's a tendency to try to get rid of it, push it away. The neutral stuff, usually there's a tendency to just ignore it and not even know that it's happening, you know. We kind of sleep through it. Well, we're kind of looking around, you know, eagerly for the pleasant stuff and noticing and trying to get rid of the unpleasant stuff. So in any case, just for example, and I think the easiest example to use is for the pleasant. When something pleasant comes along, there's this craving that very easily arises, that impulse to hold on to it, to seek it out, to try to keep it going if we can. And then when this clinging, when this craving becomes very intense or very fixed, it becomes clinging. So when it becomes clinging, it's more than just, oh, I like this thing, I'd like to have this thing. It becomes more this kind of sense of, I'm really attached to this thing, I have to have this thing. This thing is, you know, part of me almost. It's very, I can't be without this thing, you know, so it's much more of a attached and obsessive feeling for this thing or experience or whatever. And then when this clinging moves on even further, we begin to identify with this thing that we're clinging to. So we build up this, it's sort of this thing that we're clinging to is, it's part of us. It's part of our idea of who we are. You know, it's like, I'm a person who has this thing or does this thing. Our way of thinking about ourselves is partly defined by this thing. And there are all sorts of things. We can cling to objects, we can cling to views and ideas that we have, we can cling to our, you know, rules about the way we think things ought to be, we cling to ideas of who we think we are. And so as this clinging becomes more intense, it solidifies into this becoming, where we're really identified with the thing. We fix our sense of self in this state or experience or the having of this thing. And we have ideas like, you know, if anger is present, we have ideas of, I'm an angry person, I'm like this. Having this, I'm happy. Having this, I'm a good person or a successful person or a beautiful person. So it's, you know, really sort of centered around our ideas of ourselves, because these objects or experiences or things are there. And then when this really comes into being fully and we have this sense of, I am this thing, then this is birth. So this identity, fully formed identity, arises. So it's just this sort of a process of this identity happens, this becoming. And when it really arrives and we're really like, okay, this is me, I'm really here, I'm really this, there's birth. So it's sort of this process. It starts with the craving and moving towards the thing and wanting it and trying to get more of it, to hanging on to it, identifying with it, finally so much that there's just a full flowering and birth of this being, which is this feeling of, this is me, you know, this is me with this thing. And then once this identity emerges, then, well, what do you think we have? The next link of the cycle, which is aging and death. So, of course, we have the birth. Well, you know, nothing really stays the same. Nothing really lasts. So this identity that we've created, this thing that we've held on to, it changes, it's lost, it passes, the experience or the object goes away, and this idea of oneself ages and dies. So in this stage, it's sort of like you may think of it as this sense of, I used to be such and such, but I am not this any longer. This idea of me has died. And then, of course, you know, if we're still caught up in this idea of, you know, I've got to find the next wonderful and happy and beautiful thing. I'll get this thing. It'll make me wonderful and happy and beautiful, and I'll be like that all the time. Well, if that happens, you know, we've got that ignorance still going on. We have all these actions conditioned by ignorance. You know, we're here in our bodies. So, you know, we see the beautiful thing, we grab the beautiful thing, we cling, we crave, we become, we're born. And then that thing doesn't work out, it goes away, we're disappointed once again, and we go through the cycle again and again and again and again. And, you know, you can kind of sort of see how this sort of works. And I think if you consider your own experience, you realize, well, yeah, I think I have done something kind of like that as I have been living my life. So finally, also in addition to this cycle of these 12 steps, another step that we're going to be looking at as part of this series this year is what's called transcendent dependent origination. And this is what happens. It describes the process that occurs when, instead of being fueled by ignorance, this cycle is fueled by wisdom. So it becomes a cycle where we get off of this endless chain of birth and death. So there's a whole another list of links in that chain too, which I'm not going to go into at this time, but just to say that this is going to be one of the things that's going to be talked about, is what happens when wisdom is really beginning to drive this rather than the ignorance, and where we can, you know, get off and get out. So this was just kind of a quick overview of all of these different parts of the cycle. And so over the next months, we'll be talking about each of these aspects, and have, for most of them, we'll have a whole month to talk about just this one aspect. So if you feel like this has been a lot of information to take in, Yeah, it is, but you don't have to worry because we're going to be talking about all this in much more detail. So tonight I'm just kind of giving you a preview of the coming attractions, so you'll kind of have a sense of where we're going to be going over this next year. And so for this month, as I mentioned before, we're going to be looking more deeply into this first link of the cycle of ignorance. And Tweri is going to be giving a complete talk on ignorance next Monday, but tonight I'm going to just say a little bit more about it to kind of get you thinking about this subject over these coming days, so you'll be sort of oriented towards that when she gives her talk. So, as I mentioned earlier, ignorance is the foundation for this whole cycle of dependent origination and is the thing that allows us to keep getting caught up over and over again in our hate, in our greed, in our delusion, and always going on this endless quest for this thing that we think will finally make our lives perfect and make us perfect, but which never really seems to, do the trick for very long. This, ignorance of the Four Noble Truths. And when you consider, all of these different steps in the cycle, you kind of can understand why it would be so that ignorance is the foundation. Because if we don't know, we don't realize, or maybe, really we don't want to know, which is very possible because it's kind of unpleasant to know some of these difficult things. If we don't know that this pleasant thing that we start reaching for is impermanent, that we don't know that it's only going to satisfy us for so long, if we don't know that it really doesn't belong to us and can never make us a perfect person ever, then there's really nothing to stop us from craving and clinging and identifying and making a new idea of ourselves out of these things that we come in contact with. There's nothing really to stop this process of becoming and birth. We don't know enough to stop it. So it just goes on and on and on. But if we do start to understand some of these things, and we do have some idea of, this pleasant thing, it's nice, but I know it's not going to last, so I'm not going to make so much of it. I know that it really doesn't say anything permanent about me, so I'm not going to get so identified with it. If we understand those things, then maybe we won't so often go from just knowing pleasant to the craving and the clinging and the becoming and the birth. So we have some potential for escaping from this cycle of samsara and delusion and suffering. So having some understanding of ignorance and being able to recognize our own ignorance is really pretty important if we're going to have some sense of freedom and, really do, as the words of the poem say, snap the flower arrows of desire. So, now, this ignorance that we're talking about, as I mentioned before, part of it is this ignorance of the Four Noble Truths. That can be because we haven't heard the teachings, because we don't have the information. Maybe we've heard about them, but we don't really understand them. Or maybe we have an intellectual understanding, so it all makes sense to us, but we haven't really experienced their truth for ourselves. Or maybe we know the truth to some extent, but not fully. And I think, that's very often the way that we feel if we've been practicing for a while. We kind of know, but we don't know as fully as we might know. It might seem a little too scary to know. We may not want to quite fully know, like a full-on experience of impermanence or of anatta, non-self. A little bit too scary, a little bit too disorienting. So it's understandable that there might be some ignorance there. We can also think of ignorance as the ignorance that occurs because we aren't really paying attention to what's going on. And in a sense, the ignorance that we have of the Four Noble Truths or of the three characteristics of, you know, impermanence, dukkha, and not-self is because we're not paying attention. If we're really paying attention, we're going to discover these things for ourselves, but we aren't necessarily always paying attention. So we don't really know what's going on. We don't notice things. We don't see them clearly. Maybe because we're sort of wrapped up in our thoughts or our dreams and aren't really looking. Or maybe we're so tied to our ideas about how things are that we don't take in any other information and see how they really are. You know, we've already made up our minds. Or maybe we're kind of afraid to see how things really are. And so when we're not seeing clearly, we often just act out of habit. We're not necessarily even aware of what we're doing. So ignorance can be because we don't have information. We have some information and don't understand it. We don't fully understand it. We don't pay attention. We're so set in our views that we can't see or hear the information. We misinterpret what we see and get caught up in delusions. We don't want to see because what we would see if we really opened our eyes to look is a little bit too scary or painful. All of those things. And I think if we consider our own experience, we can see that there's no lack of these kinds of experiences. You know, we all have them in our understanding of the Four Noble Truths, most certainly, and also just in our understanding of many other things that go on in our everyday lives and, you know, feelings we have, things we experience. It's so common that we take what is impermanent as permanent, even if on some level we know better. We take what is unsatisfying as going to be satisfying, maybe forever, even if we know better. And we take what is impersonal as personal, even if on some level we know better. We find ourselves doing these things, even when on some level we know that it really isn't like that. And we certainly can see in our everyday lives times when we don't have complete information, when we don't understand the information we have. We think we know what's going on, but later we find out that it really wasn't and we were all wrong. So what I would suggest over the coming week is that you take some time to reflect on this topic of ignorance and just look and see how it appears in your practice. Look and see how it appears in your everyday life. You might consider the Four Noble Truths or the three characteristics of impermanence, dukkha or unsatisfactoriness or and non-self or anatta, and just sort of see, you know, where are the areas where I feel like there is ignorance, where I maybe don't understand this, or where I don't understand it deeply enough to actually act from it in my daily life. You might notice as you go about your daily activities times when you're just really not paying attention and you're kind of lost in a dream world and you're ignorant of what's going on around you in your own body and your own mind. Or you might notice when you're just acting out of habit, or, you know, not really aware of what you're doing, just, you know, the reactions that come up. Or when you're acting out of confusion, or acting out of what you're absolutely sure is really true, but maybe you haven't questioned enough. And maybe might also reflect on the role that this ignorance plays in, you know, keeping this cycle of dependent origination going in your own life, in whatever way you understand it, just this sort of cycle of always looking for the next best thing, always thinking you're going to find, you know, the magic bullet or this or that, or always sort of daydreaming up, oh, when I get this, then I'm finally going to be happy, or, oh, how I'm going to be after I accomplish blah, blah, blah goal, or, you know, this kind of thinking. Just being aware of that and kind of seeing how the ignorance plays into creating these cycles over and over. So that's a lot to kind of, you know, maybe sort of reflect on and think of. There might be certain parts that are really seem interesting to you or relevant to you. I didn't set out any homework because I know that Tweri will have her own reflections and practices to give you, but these are just some thoughts. So kind of, you know, maybe over the next week, you might have your little card, you know, kind of think about this cycle and sort of keep this idea of ignorance and noticing ignorance as it plays out in your experience. And this may have you coming to the talk on Monday with lots of thoughts and questions and maybe really eager to hear more about ignorance and another perspective on this topic. So keeping these teachings in mind, let's sit for just a few moments together. And I'd like to end with some additional words of the Buddha from the Dhammapada. Mistaking the false for the true, and the true for the false, you overlook the heart and fill yourself with desire. See the false as false, the true as true. Look into your heart and follow your own nature. So now we have some time for any comments or questions that anybody might have about the talk tonight. either is fine. Questions are good. Or if you also have something that's come to mind that you would like to share with the rest of us, that's great too. So the floor is open for your input. Oh, first, yeah.
My understanding of contact is that it relates to sensations meeting consciousness, like the conscious, six conscious. So how does that relate to the consciousness that's at the third link, like after mental formations, before name and form, and a couple links before contact?
I think that the... Oh, yes. His question was about in some ways of describing this contact, they talk about like eye consciousness. This is what you're talking about, right? Eye consciousness or ear consciousness and this sort of consciousness associated with each sense door. And how does that relate to the consciousness that's, well, some of this I find confusing also. But I think that these different forms of consciousness, this is sort of part of that link of consciousness, that there is the capacity to know. And so consciousness of the, you know, information, visual information, consciousness of auditory information, etc., etc. So I think that it's kind of, it's all part of that consciousness. And then the other part where they talk about the sense doors is just that we have those parts of the body that enable us to take the information in. And I'm not sure if I'm completely correct about that, technically correct about that, but I think that's kind of as how I understand it. And you might want to ask, you know, Twary, or when she talks about this, or when we go in more detail. I think there's going to be a more detailed discussion about this link of consciousness, and I think maybe the different ways that it's talked about in the teachings will be explained more fully there. So, yeah, thanks for that question. And then there was somebody else had a question. Yeah.
Lendl, you talked some about something about some of the reasons that might contribute to ignorance.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Well, I think that sense of not wanting to know, I know this is something that I certainly have experienced in my practice. And when you think about the three characteristics, the truth of impermanence, the truth of dukkha or unsatisfactoriness or suffering, and this truth of anatta or non-self, they're truths that are not really comfortable truths. We would much rather feel like things are, we don't really want to have to feel that painful things are going to be part of life and we have to go through aging, sickness, and death, whether we want to or not. We don't want to really know that everything we love sooner or later is going to change or we're going to lose it. We want to feel like we're a solid being, and the idea that perhaps we are not is rather disorienting and scary. So as we begin to see these things through our meditation practice, sometimes a lot of fear comes up. And there's a kind of not wanting to really experience this as deeply as we might, and a kind of pulling back. So we kind of have to approach these things, you know, gently with a lot of compassion. And so I think having that fear and having to, you know, I want to know, but I only want to know just so much feeling, I think it's pretty common. And if you feel like that sometimes, at least as from my experience, you're not alone. I certainly have felt that before. And that's something that we just sort of work through and go through as we practice. So, you know, working with that kind of fear is part of the process. It's not easy. It's not easy. So, yeah, thanks for that question. And it's good to be aware of that in ourselves and to be kind to ourselves when it does arise.
Mm-hmm. And I think ignorance is like one of those things that we don't see. I mean, I just started seeing it. And the whole word ignorance is like one of those words you don't even want to apply to yourself ever.
Mm-hmm. It does.
Before you know it, you're there. And anyway, it's a really good practice, and it's really helped me see things that I might not have.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you. Encouragement for everybody else. Yeah, I think it is. It is a hard topic, and I think the hardest things to see are, you know, ignorance and delusion. I mean, it's. We can sort of feel greed and feel hatred, but delusion is really hard. I mean, if we're deluded, we're not going to see that we're deluded, you know. So those they're different, difficult topics. So it's a good thing to kind of be aware of seeing, can I actually recognize when I am lost? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I've never heard it stated like that. It's definitely stirring things up. I wonder if you can say more about that, more about what you mean by that or what that looks like.
Mm-hmm. This is part of this whole idea of dukkha. You know, this unsatisfactoriness of things. So it's this kind of the idea that any kind of conditioned experience we have, it might be really pleasant, but it's never going to be fully satisfactory because it's impermanent. It's always going to change or leave or become boring or something, you know, so that if we, it doesn't mean that we don't get, you know, pleasure from different things that we do or enjoyment from different things that we do, but if we have this idea that it's going to bring us lasting satisfaction forever and everything will be good once we get that thing, that is never going to happen. So it's that idea, you know. Maybe anything else? Oh, back here. I didn't see you back there.
Yeah, they've already been asked, but what happens when you, okay, so when you feel absolutely sure that you know something, you know, to your point,
I don't think right off the bat, investigation.
Yeah, yeah, good. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and just looking. I mean, if you are so fixed in your idea, maybe just investigating and ask yourself, well, you know, is this really true? How do I know this? You know, of course there are certain things that I think where you could probably legitimately say that you recognize that, yeah, this is truth. But if we're kind of stuck in some fixed view about something and we're not really willing to see any other information or look at any other information, yeah, it's good to investigate and maybe ask questions, you know. Is this really true? Is this the whole picture? Yeah. Uh-huh.
Yesterday, Sunday morning, when we were talking about it, one of the people offered that he found that being really kind of humorous with himself was helpful, kind of saying, oh, yeah, Mr. Know-It-All. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, good.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. I was just going to add that despite my own habit to think about truth in terms of what's like logical, factual, and all this stuff, it's kind of like I work in academia, so that's my natural habit. One of the things I found to be helpful for me is to not ask whether it's not just what would be the case for me if it were not true? Would it just be that I'm wrong? Or is it actually much more tied up with my position in the world, my relationships with the world and others? And that's another angle that I think has been really helpful for me to really get past that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's wonderful. Yeah, did everybody hear that? Talking to Yeah, he was talking about how in this, you know, question of holding to fixed views, and that it was very helpful also to ask oneself, well, what is my stake in this being true? What does its being true really mean to me about my idea of who I am or my place in the world or how I see the world? You know, what's at stake for me in this being true? And that can open up a lot of things to look at. So, yeah, wonderful. Thank you so much. And I guess probably, do we have announcements tonight? No announcements, except maybe the announcement to remember that Rodney Smith, our guiding teacher, is having a non-residential retreat this weekend, which I think you can still sign up for, go to, etc. Crossing our fingers, assuming we aren't going to be snowed in. So that's the main thing I think of, I can think of to maybe